Shalom and welcome. I am Richard Address, Director of Jewish Sacred Aging, and we welcome you to another in our series of Jewish Sacred Aging podcasts. These podcasts hope to feature conversations that relate to issues that touch on the impact of longevity within our community. And we welcome your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com. And it is with great pleasure we welcome to our podcast microphones Shelley Christensen, the author of the major book on Jewish disabilities, Jewish Community Guide to Inclusion of People with Disabilities. And if I'm not mistaken, Shelley, in the process of developing a new book, From Longing to Belonging, Empowering Faith Communities to Include People with Disabilities, which is due out sometime this year. And for our purposes, especially for this podcast, you are the co-founder of the Jewish Disability Awareness and Inclusion Month, which is in February when we're targeting this podcast. So by way of a introduction, welcome, Shelley. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Richie. I'm honored to be here and always excited to raise awareness and talk about inclusion of people with disabilities in faith communities. And it's a great honor.
Well, thank you. I know of your work. You really are a pioneer in this and really helped raise the awareness all over the United States of America. And if I'm not mistaken, the world as well. Talk to me a little bit about the Disabilities Awareness and Inclusion Month. This has been a pet of yours, a project. It's coming into fruition. It's several years old, if I'm not mistaken. What's the genesis of this? What moved you to do this?
It started really simply. I am a member of the Jewish Special Education International Consortium, which is a group that had been meeting regularly for 30 years, made up of people who were involved in their central agencies in special education. And about the time I joined that group, they were well into their 20th year. And I joined as a new member and one of the few people really involved in Jewish community inclusion. So going beyond special education and addressing the needs of children and up to about age, to really looking at what it meant for lifelong engagement in one's Jewish community, in one's faith community. And I started doing this work in Minneapolis, where I'm from, at Jewish Family and Children's Service of Minneapolis, working with congregations and Jewish agencies to help foster inclusion, to help raise awareness, to help smooth that road and help congregations see that people with disabilities are not somebody's mitzvah project, but really are people who actively want to be engaged in congregational life just like anyone else. So at the meeting of this Jewish Special Education Consortium in 2008, one of my colleagues, Lenore Lehman, who is from Maryland, came to me and she said, "What do you think about holding an entire month just to focus on disability inclusion?" She said, "We have conferences, different communities have conferences, and they have them in the fall, and they have them, you know, various times of year, and they're all different. What if we just had a month where people could hold their conferences, we could share resources, we could promote them together and do that kind of thing?" So I said, "You know, let's bring it to the consortium and see what they have to say." And we did. We brought it to the members of the consortium at our 2008 meeting, and everybody said, "That's great. Now who's going to coordinate this?" And I raised my hand and I said, "I will," because I love, not only do I love a challenge, but I love challenging the status quo. And this is such a passion of mine. I thought, this is fun. This is going to be fun. So it started in 2009. That was the first it was called JDAM, Jewish Disability Awareness Month. And it's kind of an unfortunate acronym, JDAM, but we went with it for many, many years. And it started with four communities. And the communities simply, they held events. We did this in Minneapolis. I think many of those four communities showed Praying with Lior, which is a wonderful film that came out in 2008, 2009. And that's how it started. And it's gone global. It's amazing.
So now bring me up to date. It's 2017. February is the month devoted mm-hmm. for this. Can you sort of like give me a magic carpet ride as to some of the programs that you're aware of that are happening?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of these, this is a very grassroots growth, but just to take you on this, I love the magic carpet ride because it's kind of how it is. After 2009, we created the logo, which anybody can use. It's a free download at www.jdaim.org. And it's a Star of David, and it's made up of ribbons, and the significance of it is that inclusion is woven into every aspect of Jewish life. And we wanted to really express that through the now iconic logo. In that same year, 2009 or 2010, sorry, Jewish Federations of North America held their first Jewish Disability Advocacy Day. And that is a collaboration between the Religious Action Center and Jewish Federations of North America. And I think at that first JDAD, there were maybe 35 or 40 people. And now it's well over 100. It's been going on every year. And the purpose of that is to bring people from across the United States to Washington, D.C., for a morning of learning about the policy issues and the concerns that are impacting people with disabilities in the United States. And they bring speakers in, and then in the afternoon, people that are attending go on visits to their congressional representatives. They sit down with them. They talk about the issues. They tell their personal stories. And it really is a way for the community to come together, the Jewish community to come together and show support, and as well as raise awareness back in their home communities that issues impacting people with disabilities are not separate from what we as Jews really believe, which is, you know, this that sense of social justice and social action. It's a very, very important part of this. This year it's being held February 2nd in Washington, D.C., and it's a great experience.
So let me, this leads right into a question, obviously, given the changes in the administration. What's your take? What are you hearing about funding possibilities, increase, decrease funding for the whole menu mm-hmm. of disabilities awareness in the United States? Are your antenna up because there's a fear that some of this funding and readjustments will get cut? Or do you see the possibility that in truth people understand this event and this need and will expand the funding?
I'm very afraid. I'm very concerned, let's put it that way. And some of the issues that, you know, the whole Affordable Care Act, if that goes away, that impacts a number of people who live with disabilities.
In what way, Shelley? Talk about that. That's really important.
Well, it is. And it provides access to affordable health care for people with disabilities who tend to oftentimes families that live with disability, individuals who live with disability, live below poverty lines or are very limited in income. The percentage of people with disabilities who are employed at competitive market rates is very, very low compared to the national average. And also a number of people with disabilities also receive Medicaid to help pay for health care. If there's block grants or cuts to Medicaid, that's going to impact people's access to health care. And pre-existing conditions, that's another big area. A lot of people do have pre-existing conditions that if they're not covered, it's really going to be chaos. And I just urge people to contact their legislators, both at the state level as well as the federal level, and, you know, and express their concerns, because this has a lot of impact. One of the positive things that's coming around, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services there's a new series of regulations coming out, the home and community-based services. And this is in 2019, states will have to have, they'll have to have their plan. And what this will do is provide access to the community pretty much like anybody else. And one of the areas that is specific to that we talk about for Jewish Disability Awareness and Inclusion Month is access to one's synagogue, to one's Jewish community, to one's faith community in a way that that a person chooses to participate and to belong. And that's going to be part of the things that through the HCBS regulations now service providers are going to have to be paying attention to. So we're working on that. I'm working on that. Actually, I just got off a call this morning with the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, Religion and Spirituality Division. And we have our annual conference in June in Hartford, Connecticut. And we are going to be doing a day-long presentation on the regulations and the impact of belonging to a faith community and providing some practical tools to help service providers empower themselves and also congregations to be empowered to support people to live their spiritual life as they wish.
So let's go back to congregation land, because I know you do a tremendous amount of consulting with congregations across the board and faith communities. What do you see happening within synagogues, churches, et cetera, that reflects this rise in awareness on this issue, on your issue? What's happening on the ground? Can you give us a real fast overview of some of the things that you've been really impressed with?
Yes, I have some of the things that, first of all, a lot of congregations hold events during the month of February. And in the beginning, I think they had a lot of parents speaking, or they had people speaking for people with disabilities. There was still this idea that inclusion in congregation land is about just opening your doors and people will come.
Right.
And we know that that's not necessarily a prescription for living a meaningful life. And when we talk about a meaningful life, this is not something that somebody else decides for us. This is something that we determine for ourselves. We choose what's important to us and so on and so forth. So we've seen a rise in people with disabilities speaking, talking about their lives. We've seen a rise in congregations holding, doing assessments of their congregation. And we've seen a lot of strategic planning happening around this. In other words, how do we determine, how do we get away from the idea that people with disabilities are somebody's service project or mitzvah project, and rather are people who also perform services, who also share and contribute their gifts to our congregation? That's the biggest change of all. And we have a long ways to go to help diminish the myth that people with disabilities are, you know, a kind of a class of people, them, rather than part of us. And that's a really, it's a challenge. And one of the things that I think has been really helpful when I'm speaking with congregations and with communities and in the work that I do, is to really sit down with people and have them tell us what's important to you in your life, in your spiritual life, your religious life, your faith life, however they choose to define that. And it can't be, you know, as broad as, you know, or as general as God or friends or things like that. It has to be really specific. What specific activities or what part of being involved in your congregation are so important to you that you can't live without them, that you don't want to live without them? So the idea behind that is that people then start to identify specific things. People and everybody identifies something different. For one person, it may be attending Torah study. For another person, it's attending services. And for another person, it's getting involved in social action that they just can't live without. It's just part of their DNA. And we work through that and explain and demonstrate how those kinds of things that they've determined are important to them, they're individually and personally important, that people with disabilities have those same things that are just as important to them. And yet, in our efforts to include people, in our efforts to do what's right, we forget that very, very important part, which is we cannot be gatekeepers to somebody else, to what's important to somebody else.
Clear up one thing that comes up a lot, and that is the ADA, the American with Disabilities Act. Congregations who are trying to retrofit the building or in a building project or maybe just building a new building, you know, they want to do a ramp, they may do the elevator, lighting, all the things that are available to help congregations. Synagogues under the jurisdiction of the ADA in the United States of America?
That is such a good question and one that we get asked frequently. According to the law, houses of worship, for the most part, are not covered by the ADA. There are some exceptions, and the exceptions would be if a synagogue or a church is renting out to another organization, say a preschool or something like that, then they would have to be compliant with the ADA. And the part of the ADA that covers employment, there are certain aspects there that congregations, you know, sometimes fall under and are covered. But for the most part, they're not. That said, as Rabbi Lynn Landsberg, the great disability rights advocate, has said, that while synagogues and houses of worship are not mandated by law, there is a moral mandate to create access. And so I always suggest that when a congregation is engaging in a campaign to raise money for their building funds, for new buildings especially, but also for existing structures, have an architect who is well versed in the ADA go through your plans, help develop your plans so that your building is accessible. And accessibility, physical architectural accessibility, is not the only part of inclusion that we talk about. It's the one that a lot of people default to because it's visible. It's very visible. The thing is, with architectural accessibility, we are aging. So what does that mean? Access into a building, access into a sanctuary, to classrooms, to any place in the building that somebody would go.
Right. Bathrooms,
lighting.
I know when we've talked about this, just the act of the lighting and how the lighting affects the sanctuary and large print prayer books. And now with a lot of congregations going to visual prayer, not everybody can see the words projected on the screen in a certain way. I mean, there's a lot of things that really need to be talked through.
Exactly.
I mean, I remember somebody when we worked on some of this together in the old days, actually talking about the placing of mezuzot in the entrance of the synagogue, to place it halfway down the sill so someone who is in a wheelchair, when they move into the building, can touch the mezuzah if they wish, because they were unable to actually get up and touch the mezuzah when it's on the top of the doorpost.
Exactly.
A little thing like that, but it makes, I remember you teaching us, it makes a very, very big difference. It's a statement.
It does. It's a statement. And, you know, and as far as an activity for a synagogue or for a religious school to do, my own synagogue in Minneapolis, Congregation Bet Shalom, several years ago decided, you know, let's make this statement. Let's lower all the mezuzot in the building. And what they did is they studied it. They studied the tradition of placing mezuzot. And as a result, they lowered the mezuzot to the lower part of the top third of the door. And they had an event during religious school on a Sunday morning where all the children participated in music and talking about respect and dignity and access for all people including kids with a lower mezuzah, the children can reach them too. And the kids actually went through the process of moving the mezuzah out in the building. That's something, that's a low cost or even no cost kind of thing that a congregation can do that really elevates awareness, really raises awareness. And, you know, these are important things. That's talking about building access, communication access. You know, we've been talking about the kind of the physical aspects, but there's also, you know, there's also supporting people to be involved in congregational life in whatever way that they need. So we can talk about leveling the playing field, I guess, so that they can participate like anyone else. It's a really important distinction.
Talk to me a little bit about, we see now a rise in the movement camps. I know the URJ camps, I think Ramah camps, conservative movement camps, a greater awareness of access and inclusion, and to some camps actually hiring inclusion specialists, which I think is the term.
It is. Mm-hmm.
How does that evolve? Where's that going? What do they do?
So how that typically works, and you know, the for example, I know a lot of the camps, the URJ camps, Camp Ramah, they've had inclusion. They've had inclusion specialists. Ramah has had a national inclusion, a national disability support program for many, many years. And it used to be, and I can kind of say this, you know, in terms of a lot of camps, and there are still camps out there that still have, you know, are kind of what we would call segregated camps. In other words, they support only kids with diagnoses, with disability diagnoses. But the trend now, and it's really being acknowledged as a best practice, is to include kids with disabilities in the day-to-day camp life. What does that mean in terms of preparation? The hardest part is for a child, especially going to camp, leaving their environment where they have their routines and where they're comfortable. Even as excited as they may be to go to camp, it's a whole new routine. It may be unfamiliar. It may be difficult to learn that routine or follow that routine. A child may need additional supports, or for example, a child may, you know, one of the things with camp, everybody dresses in the same room, or they shower. Some kids have sensitivity to water, that kind of thing, and maybe don't want to be with the other kids. Maybe they're embarrassed. This is, you know, just kind of a typical thing that happens. And so what the inclusion specialist does is really does sort of a scan, an in-depth scan of what a child needs in his or her life to be successful. They may talk to school personnel. They may talk to parents. They may interview the child in that child's home environment. And the idea behind all of this is to put the supports in place at camp so that the child succeeds. So for example, if a kid has difficulty with managing changes to their routine, or even to their food that they have for breakfast, for example, instead of just hauling a kid out of bed and hauling him down to the dining hall and saying, okay, you have to eat this. This is what you're having. You know, an attempt is made then to accommodate that child, to make sure, you know, how can we get this kid out of bed in a way that they're going to, you know, feel safe. They're going to feel comfortable, that kind of thing. These are little things that can be done. And this is oftentimes the inclusion specialist may set that up. They also do training at camp. And that's a fairly new thing. They will train their entire camp staff, not on, you know, the specialness or the uniqueness of a kid with a diagnosis with a disability, but on how they also bring and share their gifts and their talents and their uniqueness with the rest of their peers. That also helps then camp counselors to facilitate peer-to-peer relationships, so things that are really the friendships, things that are really important at camp, so that essentially everybody's there as a unique individual. Everybody is there having a good time, hopefully. in camp. So this has been a really good practice because it provides that extra level of support to not only the child and the family, but to the rest of the camp staff. And it doesn't necessarily mean in a lot of camps, it doesn't necessarily mean that if something happens or if a counselor or a specialist doesn't know what to do, that they immediately go running to the inclusion specialist. It also teaches them to have the confidence to sort of, you know, to have the knowledge of the kid and also to even improvise on their own to make something work. And improvisation is a really key piece to successful participation and inclusion.
Because that's how we learn a lot. That's how we learn.
Exactly. Yep, and we do make mistakes, and that's okay.
Wanted to ask you something about, it's just pretty much normal now in most congregations, in my experience, dealing with the ceremonies of bar and bat mitzvah, that congregations will have access to the, you know, their children with disabilities, special programs, you know, individualized bar bat mitzvah instruction tailored to an individual, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a use of tech, I've seen this also growing, a use of technology. So could you just talk, before we start running out of time here, the rise of technological aids, computer programs, apps to assist a family in teaching children, perhaps with special needs or various types of disabilities, not only in preparation for bar bat mitzvah, but for Jewish education as a whole. Are you seeing this?
You know, and there are a lot of, there's a lot of apps that people can use. There's, you know, and there's trope trainers. There's a lot of different things like that for bar and bat mitzvah study. And what I want to say is, and I guess I should disclose too, the hats that I wear, I'm a bar bat mitzvah tutor at my synagogue. I've been doing that for longer than I've been in the disability field. But I guess what I've really come to understand, and I think is really helpful for synagogues to understand, is that every child is unique, every single kid. And whether, you know, they come in and their Hebrew skills are phenomenal and amazing, you know, they may have anxiety or, you know, they could be anything, you know, it could be kids, you know, kids with autism, kids with anything. And the thing that's so critical, I think, is for the entire staff of the synagogue, and especially the tutor, to have a really good relationship, not only with the family, but to take the time to get to know the child and to not rely so much on that, you know, you have, 36 weeks or whatever to teach this child and get it done, so to speak, but to really take some time with the child and step back and learn and build that relationship with that child. And, you know, sometimes, yes, there are apps, there are a variety of different things, you know, when a child is giving a Devar Torah, I've seen kids do artwork or, you know, certainly PowerPoint presentations, things that they're comfortable doing, signing the blessings, and, you know, just any number of things. And again, it's very creative. But one of my former students would come in every week, and there were, you know, some of the issues that he had, he liked to turn the light switch on and off. So in talking with mom and dad, we instituted it's an accommodation, not very technological, but if he didn't turn the lights off when he got in, he would get a baseball card. We had a ritual, and a lot of kids like these rituals. And this particular child would come in and he'd ask how my dog was. And we'd go through a litany of how the dog was, and we'd then get down to study. He was ready. He needed that transition time just to come in and get settled. And he needed that routine. So there are those kinds of things. There are apps that teach Hebrew. I just turned my phone off, darn. But I've downloaded a couple of those that I share with my students. I think one of the really big things with bar and bat mitzvah training too is that we have the ability now to record you know, directly on our own phones, our smartphones, or our computers to record the Torah readings and to do it verse by verse, or even for some kids, just small little chunks to teach them, and they go into their own file, and we can coordinate between that, what they're hearing being chanted as a tool, and coordinating it to what they're seeing on the page. And a lot of kids, you know, having that, I guess, kind of an individualized way of listening and seeing the information, it starts to come together. And that's the amazing thing. And by the time a child reaches that moment where they're having their celebration, it seems to have all come together in a really organic way.
One of the other questions I wanted to ask you before we start running out of time has to do, in many ways, the constituency of Jewish sacred aging. There is, I've run across this as I travel, and I'm interested to see in your consulting and your work, if you've dealt with this, I would be shocked if you haven't. And that is the individuals in their 70s, 80s, and 90s now who have been caring for an adult child. Who may be in their 40s or 50s, and they've been caring for them and taking care of them in their home, but they're facing their own mortality, and they really just don't know how to make plans for who's going to take care of my son, who's going to take care of my daughter after I'm gone, because of their challenges and their disability challenges. How I'm sure you've run into this, you know, how do we begin to talk to that elder parent, that older adult who is concerned about their adult child?
Mm-hmm. That's such a great question. And I think first and foremost for parents in that, you know, in these 70s, 80s age range, they were parenting their child well before the idea of inclusion, well before the idea of special education, and well before the idea of employment and independent living and all these things now that, you know, that are available to so many people. And so they've never really availed themselves. They've never really gone that, you know, they've never introduced their adult child to the Center for Independent Living, which every state in the country has several. They've never, you know, they may not have access to, they may not have inquired about healthcare or Social Security, disability, or any of those things. So they really are in the dark. And I think that it would be really useful for particularly congregations to partner with family service agencies in their community and reach out to these families, and whether it's inviting them to come for a Sunday morning brunch to talk about the future because it's on their minds, or whether it's individual counseling or support or introducing people to the resources or making those resources available to parents. I think that's really important. That's number one. Number two is the big thing, I think, that we're starting to recognize as the role of siblings. And I can speak to my own children, and who are I don't know what generation they're in, but they're in their own generation. They're in their late 20s, early 30s. And I've encountered this with a number of siblings in that age range. They do not want to be caregivers for their siblings. They don't want to have that 24/7 caregiving like their parents have done in the past, or that they see. That's not an option, because they've grown up in an era where people with disabilities are part of the community. They've grown up in an era where their siblings have had education. They've been included. They've been part. They see their sibling not as a disabled person or a person with a disability. They see their sibling as a person, as their sibling. So in talking to a lot of young adults, you know, they believe in the possibilities. Does that mean they're not going to have their sibling live with them? You know, they don't know these things yet, but they're a lot more open to the idea that their sibling has, you know, deserves to live this life, not, you know, under the care of another family member, but to live independently, or, and how to achieve that. And that's a whole other, that's a whole public movement. And that's also part of, by the way, the coming back to the political situation, you know, being, for people to live in their community.
Shelley, if somebody wanted to touch base with you, connect with what you're doing, what, mm-hmm. what's the website? How do they get in touch with you?
My website is www.inclusioninnovations.com. And you can reach me through the website. Also, my email, Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y, at inclusioninnovations.com. And for JDAME, we also have a link to that same website. If you just type in www.jdaim.org into your browser, it'll take you to resources for Jewish Disability Awareness and Inclusion Month. It includes a full guide on activities and things you can do for Jewish Disability Awareness and Inclusion Month and beyond. And it's the and beyond we're most interested in, because this isn't about one month. This is about a life. It's about many lives. And the clock is ticking on those lives. People are tired of waiting. They want to be part of the community.
And we, just so people know that this podcast, which will go be posted in conjunction with the launch of Jewish Disabilities and Awareness and Inclusion Month, and we'll be linking that. And Shelley has a reflection also that will be posted on the website and then archived on the website as well. So Shelley Christensen, thank you very, very much for your time, your expertise, and most of all, your love and dedication to really making a difference in this world, which you have done, and knowing you will continue to do so. So continued good luck, and
thank you, Richie.
Of yourself and your family and your mom and everybody, and just a big hug long distance, okay?
Oh, for sure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And to all of you, thank you for listening to the latest in our series of podcasts here on Jewish Sacred Aging. All of these podcasts are archived on our website, www.jewishsacredaging.com. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. And we invite you to visit the website and the site's Facebook page, and look forward to greeting you at our next session. And thank you very much for your support and attention. And a reminder that these podcasts are recorded through the facilities of Lubetkin Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Until the next time, Lehitra Oak. Thank you, Shelley.
Thanks, Richie.